www.learningexchange.ubc.ca/CITR to find out more.
Hello, I'm Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. Two weeks ago, a 2,000-kilogram elephant seal washed up on the shores of Vancouver Island, providing scientists with a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to study a mammal that rarely ventures near Canadian waters. Elephant seals are rarely seen because they spend most of their life at the bottom of the ocean searching for food. Andrew Trites, director of the UBC Marine Mammal Research Unit, said, "Never in 100 years would I have ever predicted that we'd find one dead in Departure Bay." Once again, we are perplexed and challenged with the question of why animals in our seas are washing up on the shores or disappearing from our oceans at an alarming rate. Is it global warming? Is it the consequence of overfishing and pollution that is upsetting the delicate balance of our oceans? Today's show is the second part of a two-part series that discusses the health of our oceans. Last week, we spoke with Dr. Daniel Polly from the UBC's Fisheries Center. Today we speak with Mr. Todd Jones about his groundbreaking research of leatherback turtles that took place right here on UBC's South Campus. In an intimate conversation with Todd Jones, we learn that leatherbacks, like so many other marine species living in our oceans, are on the brink of extinction. You are listening to Prof Talk. My guest today is Todd Jones, a PhD candidate from the UBC Department of Zoology. Mr. Jones currently works in the area of bioenergetics, the field of study now being coined as conservation physiology. His goals are to understand the bioenergetics energy use allocation of sea turtles and how resource availability, abundance, and human perturbations such as climate change affect the reproductive output and growth. And all of this is in the context of population decline. His research is based on the fundamental principle that growth rate and metabolic rate are the two most important factors for understanding a species and for managing a species on the brink of extinction. Todd Jones is a recipient of the Dean Fisher Memorial Scholarship in Marine Biology, and most recently, he was chosen as one of Pop Science magazine's Brilliant 10. I reached Todd Jones at his lab. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
First, I want to congratulate you on being chosen as one of PopSci's Brilliant 10 Young Scientists.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful honor. It's great to be sort of recognized by your peers, and also it's a great way to sort of give back to the community and raise awareness for sea turtles.
Now, Mr. Jones, your research of leatherback turtles is groundbreaking. To this date, no one in the world has been able to raise and study more than one leatherback turtle in captivity for such a long period. Can you tell us about some of your achievements?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, you sort of pinpoint on one of the main ones there is the ability to have a group of leatherback sea turtles, and that we've been able to do studies with. You know, you had to have greater than an N of one in order to perform certain experiments and research studies, and so what we've been able to do is maintain a group of leatherbacks for nearly 2.5 years, and that has allowed us to do research into the basic biology and the early developmental biology of these turtles. And the main thing to remember is that these leatherbacks are critically endangered, and so since the 1980s, the numbers, the population has been plummeting, and for instance, in the Pacific Ocean, there was maybe 180,000 leatherbacks in 1980, and it's down to less than 5,000. And the issue with sea turtles is that the females come onto tropical beaches and lay eggs, and then the females go back into the water. 60 to 80 days later, the hatchlings sort of pip from the egg, emerge from the sand, and crawl down. And then we don't really see them again until they show up as subadults or adults at foraging grounds and nesting beaches. So it's been sort of coined the lost years. And so we didn't really know where they were going, where were the nursery grounds, how they were making their living, as in what they were eating, how much resources they required, how fast they were growing. And so in order to conserve the species, you have to understand it and understand where it's going and its habits. And so what we were able to do is maintain a research group in the lab in order to do some of these studies.
Now, can you describe the lab?
So what we had was basically a bunch of tanks. And so we had oval holding tanks. We had isolation tanks if we had to isolate a particular animal. We also had tanks that we did our different experiments in, be it for thermoregulation studies or growth studies or metabolic studies. And so we brought these hatchlings in from the British Virgin Islands, and they pipped from the egg, emerged from the sand. We scooped them up, a small group of them from a nest, put them in canvas coolers and brought them overnight, flew with them from BVI back to Canada to our labs here. And then what we have is all these tanks are filled with salt water, and the salt water comes in from the Vancouver Aquarium and Marine Science Center. And the animals are actually tethered in there on these. Leatherback sea turtles are what we call oceanic pelagic. Oceanic means off the continental shelf, so out in the deep ocean, and pelagic means water column. So they're an animal that's sort of this without really spending time on the bottom. So they're not neritic. They're not bottom dwelling. Nor do they sort of live around reefs or rocks. They're just sort of open ocean swimmers. And this is sort of the things you have to deal with having them in captivity. Dive in any direction or dive down, but they weren't able to hit the tank walls or bottoms, which could lead to cuts and abrasions. And also they couldn't run into each other, which, sea turtles will actually at this stage will bite each other if they're in close proximity. And so that was the lab setup, and it's sort of an indoor-outdoor setting. It was covered over by a roof, but it was open to ambient light, and we had all these tanks out there with circulating water, with UV filtration, protein skimmers, sand filters, UV filtration to keep the water quality high, and we also maintained the temperature. The animals were raised at about 24 degrees Celsius.
Now, is that tether system what has been termed the Jolly Jumper harness that you pioneered?
Right. The Jolly Jumper aspect of it was sort of given it that name by the media. I personally didn't know what a Jolly Jumper was until someone called it that. But that is the harness. That harness has been what has allowed us to maintain them. Since the 1930s, researchers, starting with Dr. Dhrani Yagala in Ceylon in India, attempted to raise leatherbacks, and in 1936, 1939, and of a group that he brought in, they lost all of their animals within the first month or two, and they only had one animal they were able to then put all their time and effort and resources into and maintain it. But even for something as simple as growth rates, captive growth rates, you can't really gain much from one organism. You sort of need a group of organisms to sort of give you your standard errors and your sensitivity analysis around these lines or these curves or these models you produce. And so, and then later on in the 70s as well as in the 80s, many researchers have attempted to maintain these turtles in captivity because it's the only way really we can do studies on them at this early life stage. We don't know because we can't find them in the open ocean. And however, everyone has ran into difficulties and lost their organisms. And so one of the main things that we were able to do to keep these animals in captivity and have them thrive in captivity has been this harness, which has been coined the Jolly Jumper, but is simply a backpack harness made of soft rubber hoses that we run 100-pound line through comes in line running to a swivel with a dowel across the tank, and that allows free range of motion in any direction and diving, but without them actually coming to the edges of the tank. And that really has been one of the unique things that has allowed us to maintain them in captivity.
Now, can you also tell us about the diet of leatherback turtles, and particularly the squid jello that you created? And again, I don't know if that's another term that was invented.
Yeah. We do actually, we have called it squid jello ourselves, and that's just sort of because, it's a fun term or it's thrown around there because we are blending squid with gelatin. But the idea is that leatherback sea turtles in the wild are what we call gelatinivores, and that means that they eat solely gelatinous zooplankton. And that would be anything from jellyfish to tinafores, anything. And even when fish release their eggs and their sperm in the ocean, what you'll have is the eggs and the sperm together sort of like in a gelatinous egg sac, and that sort of free floats around the ocean. So anything gelatinous, leatherbacks will eat. And so when you want to feed them in captivity, you have to sort of find, come up with a diet that matches the consistency of jellyfish so that they will accept it, so that they will eat it. And also there's issues with gut impaction, blocking the gut, if they can digest the food or not. And so what happens is previous researchers have attempted to feed them fish or feed them shrimp, and it can actually get into the digestive system, and they can't digest it, and it leads to a blockage of the gut, which then builds up bacteria, and these bacteria can go systemic, and the animal can die from septicemia or bacteremia. So the animal has to, the leatherbacks have to be able to digest the food you offer them. And also, if they bite into something too hard, if you offer them a bigger piece of shrimp or something harder, if they bite into it and it doesn't have the right consistency, the animal won't accept the food. It'll sort of open its mouth up, reject the food, and try to swim away as fast as possible and go into a frenzy type state. And so by taking squid, which is a very lean protein, low in fat, and by cleaning the squid, taking just the mantles and the tentacles, and then blending this with hot water, gelatin, and then adding your basic reptile vitamins and minerals that you could buy at any pet shop for snakes or lizards. But blending those together, we actually are able to make a jelly-like substance, a food that sort of mimics jellyfish in its consistency. And we also match the water content of jellyfish. Jellyfish are 90 to 95% water, and so our food also has a high water content. And now this food, the animals readily accept. When you give it to them, they don't reject the food because it has the same texture, same consistency as jellyfish. They readily take it down, and then we've actually been able to, with our food and our regime, our feeding regime, we've been able to replicate the conditioning of sea turtles, of leatherback sea turtles in the wild, meaning that our animals are matching the same length to body mass ratio that you would have for wild organisms. And that's been really a key component to making sure that all the research we do is applicable to what's happening in the wild, and that we're matching the growth rates and the body conditioning of wild organisms.
Now, you had a team of volunteers feeding these turtles on a daily basis. How many pounds of this Jell-O do they actually eat?
We did. I want to say over the two and a half, the nearly 3 years, we probably had anywhere from 10 to 15 UBC undergraduates. And it was, the work, we couldn't have done it without them. It was imperative to have that many. And it was great to be in a situation where you could have that many enthusiastic volunteers. And part of the what they would do is they'd come in is that they would clean squid, prepare the food, blend the food, make the squid jello, clean the tanks. On Wednesdays was measuring days, so whatever volunteer we had on that day would help us take the animals out of the tanks, measure the animals for carapace length. Carapace is the upper shell. They would measure the shell length. We get the mass of the animals, shell width. We'd measure the flippers and the head. On those days, the tanks were completely drained. Once a week, the tanks were completely drained. We then scrubbed the inside of the tanks with a quaticide. Fresh seawater was brought in via truck from the Vancouver Aquarium. It was pumped back into our tanks. So the volunteers were essential to our program and to our project. And one of the main things, too, is that, these animals were eating every single day. And to answer your question as to how much they ate, I mean, that would sort of changed over time. Obviously, when you have, the organisms are only 50 grams, they're not eating that much. But by the time the organisms were 10 kilograms, the sea turtles, that is, were 10 kilograms, or even 45 kilograms, these animals could individually be eating, 4 kilograms, 5 kilograms of food a day, 10 pounds of squid. And so every single day, Monday through Friday, and then we also had volunteers that excelled that end up becoming weekend volunteers that had keys to our lab. Anywhere from, 20 pounds or more of squid was being processed and blended and made into food for these sea turtles.
Now, as juveniles, the leatherback turtles are not big, but they do have the potential to grow quite big. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about their growth rate in general?
Yes, so it's sort of a relative term. They come in, they hatch from the egg, they pip from the egg and emerge on beaches at about 45, anywhere from 40 to 50 grams. And within 2 years, they're reaching 45 kilograms. That's three orders of magnitude change. So 45 kilograms are roughly 100 pounds. And so we call them juveniles, but at 2 years or so, they are actually, you know, quite large. That is the size, a two to two-and-a-half-year-old juvenile leatherback at 45 kilograms, that could be, you know, the size that some species of sea turtles mature at. For instance, a Kemp's Ridley or Olive Ridley turtle don't get much larger than that mass and that length that our leatherbacks attained. However, relative to leatherbacks, it's not that large. For instance, they were 45 kilograms at 2 to 2.5 years, but an adult leatherback could be anywhere from 250 to 550 kilograms. And the largest male leatherback ever recorded was 918 kilograms, and that animal was unfortunately died in commercial fishing gear off of the coast of, I believe it was the United Kingdom. And so they actually can get very large in length, and in length they can probably get around 150 to 160 centimeters. I think maybe the largest, maybe up into 178 centimeters carapace length, and that's the length of just their shell. And, you know, then if you add on the head and the tail and the other processes, they can be very long and massive.
I've just heard the song titled Histoire du Tango Café 1930 from the album Tehake from the UBC School of Music, played on flute by Professor Lorna McGee and on harp by Professor Heidi Crutzen. We now conclude the interview with Mr. Todd Jones. Now, you said right at the beginning that leatherback turtles are an endangered species. Why are their populations in such decline?
So they are actually endangered, and leatherbacks are critically endangered, which is the highest level of endangerment given by the IUCN red listing. And sea turtles have been in trouble for many years due to harvesting. They initially were harvested for meat and as a food throughout the Caribbean and in other tropical locations. And countries by indigenous people. And they also then, once there was sort of a ban on harvesting and selling, even in the United States, in the Keys, they used to have a green turtle soup cannery where they would capture green turtles and butcher them and sell the meat, and actually would can green turtle soup, happening right in the United States and Florida. So in both third world countries and in countries such as the United States and others, there's been sort of the harvesting of turtles, of sea turtles. And then there was also nest habitat destruction. So where these animals nested in the tropics and tropical beaches, you have loss due to homes, due to resort hotels and tourism, and due to the expansion, you know, just of cities and people moving to these areas. Sea turtles were losing their nesting habitat, and also the destruction of foraging habitat. For instance, places such as in the Bahamas, where green turtles eat seagrasses. You had seagrasses diminishing as marinas were built, or as boats were mooring or out into the waters. Their prop scars, and also from coming into shallow waters, and also anchor scars were destroying these foraging habitats of sea turtles. So all this is happening. So you see a dwindling in the numbers of turtles. And now we believe the most predominant issue with the population declines is probably as bycatch in commercial fisheries. And so, for instance, longline fisheries that are out catching, they can release 60 to 90 miles of a line with thousands of hooks. These are actually bycatching sea turtles. So they have a target species. For instance, it could be tuna or billfish. However, loggerhead sea turtles could be attracted to a squid bait. Or if these long lines happen to be in areas where many organisms are congregating because it's got favorable resources, then leatherbacks and other sea turtles could be coming to these areas, and they're actually foul hooked. They're in the area, and this long line is being pulled in, dragged into the boat, and as it's going by, it actually sort of can hook or foul hook the turtle. Then you also have drift gillnet, and these nets are nets actually put out into the open water that just sort of drift around, and turtles can actually swim. They're supposed to catch, again, pelagic fish and billfish, but they can catch anything from marine mammals to sea turtles, and sea turtles can actually swim into them and get tangled. And so this has been the major decline. We believe in the Pacific that there could be as high as a 34% annual mortality of adult sea turtles. And what's really important is that we know that naturally there's a high mortality rate for hatchlings. And that's why an individual female can lay up to 100 eggs in one nesting episode. And throughout a season, an individual female may nest 7 times. So she could be nesting, let's just say, to make it easy, 700 eggs in a season. And then she might come back 2 years later and lay 700 eggs again. So nature sort of takes care of the high mortality for the hatchlings. But what humans are getting involved through fisheries and through destroying habitat is that this high mortality of adults. And that is why we're losing them. You know, it can take, for a leatherback sea turtle, it can take maybe up to 15 to 20 years to reach sexual maturity. For a hard-shelled sea turtle, such as a green turtle, it may take over 30 years to reach sexual maturity. So for 30 years, this animal is out in the open waters, collecting resources, foraging, and moving about. And then it's never nested yet. And 30 years later, or for a leatherback, 20 years later, it finally reaches the adult size and maturity level that it's able to start nesting for the first time. And on its way to a nesting beach, it could be caught in a longline fishery. So all these resources were for naught. This animal never had a chance to nest. And so this mortality of the adults is what is leading to these population declines in these animals. And right now, the way the animals are, the way their nesting habitat and how many eggs they produce, and these long-lived species are not capable to withstand these pressures we're putting on them through bycatch to commercial fisheries.
Now, you describe these turtles as charismatic and beautiful and graceful under the sea. I mean, I can imagine you've become quite close to your subjects, and in say some the way we might be to our own pets. What inspires you to continue your research, given in knowing that some of the estimates of these turtles, they might not even be around, and there's that possibility of them being extinct. What keeps you going?
Yeah, to go back and start with the first parts of your question there, I mean, they are. When people think of, for instance, a turtle, the idea of a turtle that, can pull itself, a tortoise that can pull itself into its shell, that, moves very slowly on land, these concepts are not what you get when you have a sea turtle. Sea turtles are extremely graceful. They have complete control of their buoyancy. They can hover at any depth in the ocean. You can see them just skimmering a couple inches above the seafloor, or you could see them, a foot or two below the surface, or sitting completely still in the column, in the water column of the ocean, maybe 10 feet above a reef and 10 feet below the surface, just sitting there. And yet at the same time, they can move very swiftly. It's quite easily for these animals to swim, you know, 10 kilometers an hour or greater, you know, just moving through the water, or at the same time just slowly gliding. And they actually fly underwater. They use a lift-based propulsion. So they sort of move their flippers and the motion of a bird's wings to create lift and fly through the ocean environment. Just very beautiful, very charismatic. And at the same time, these turtles they started over 100 million years ago. So leatherback sea turtles and other sea turtles, for instance, green turtles maybe 40 to 60 million years ago, these leatherbacks were alive during the Cretaceous period, during the end of the dinosaurs. So leatherbacks and dinosaurs were actually on Earth at the same time. And so for 100 million years, this unique charismatic animal that, for instance, for a leatherback that eats jellyfish solely, they can get so large that dives over 1,000 meters, dives as deep as Weddell seals and sperm whales, down to the depths of the ocean where it's completely dark, and they feed on bioluminescent jellyfish. You know, they can feed on jellyfish, lion's mane jellies that are 15 to 20 foot long, and yet they digest these jellyfish that have these stinging nematocysts, and yet it's not toxic to sea turtles. It doesn't bother them. They're this really unique creature that's been around for a really long time, and they are beautiful and graceful under the sea. And then you realize that, you know, you look at the time frame of humans and how long we've been around, and it's, you know, we're a blink of an eye. We're very, you know, compared to, you know, to the length of time of sea turtles, and the fact that to what we're doing, how we're going about our lives, and how we're polluting the oceans, and how we're sort of just taking, gleaning from the ocean all its resources, and that we are directly causing the population decline, the probable extinction of these animals. I just can't see. I can't fathom that, how we can allow that to happen. And that, I think, is what drives me. You know, I started off being interested in marine biology. I grew up watching Jacques Cousteau and wanted to go into this rim. And I was interested in all marine life. But I started working with sea turtles a decade ago. And once you start working with sea turtles, and once you start realizing the plight of sea turtles and how this magnificent creature is on its way out, you know, you can't help but be transformed. And I have now sort of, my whole scientific career is specifically working with sea turtles and with leatherbacks. And I just don't see how anyone who were to get involved with them couldn't feel that way and couldn't be inspired to do anything they can. Rather, in my case, it's research and working on conservation. In other cases, it could be, you know, awareness. And I also work in education of people about that. And people from all walks of life could work in changing their own lives to help benefit marine, you know, marine fauna, such as sea turtles and any organisms, and also work specifically for sea turtles in awareness and education of, you know, of other people. And it's imperative that more people get involved in situations like this. For instance, you inviting me onto your show to talk about this research, it's going to expand the awareness and the plight of sea turtles. There's probably maybe people listening that didn't know that sea turtles were going extinct, or that even that maybe leatherback sea turtles are in Canadian waters, British Columbian waters, and Nova Scotia. So it's just, you know, it's really important.
Well, it has been such a privilege to speak with you. Thank you so much, Todd.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate it. I really enjoy doing things like this. It's a great media, you know, to get the information out there and increase the awareness of these creatures.
Just listening to an interview with Mr. Todd Jones from the UBC Department of Zoology talk about his research of leatherback turtles. If you would like more information about leatherback turtles in Canada, please visit www.seaturtle.ca. You can also find more information about leatherbacks at www.leatherback.org. If you would like to see how you can get involved in ocean conservation, visit www.oceanrevolution.org. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM on the Point Grey campus in Vancouver. You're listening to the song titled Malaxi from the album Recuerdos, performed by Professor Michael Strutt on guitar from the UBC School of Music. We would love to hear your comments and feedback of the show. Please email us at proftalk@gmail.com or visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also listen to the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farha Khan. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
This is Lonnie Bristle. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.